Good morning, everyone, and thank you for choosing to be here. So the goal of my work is to improve failure management in MapReduce systems. So I'll begin with an overview of what the built-in fault tolerance mechanisms in Hadoop are, which is the open source implementation I'm focusing on, how early fault detection can help mitigate performance penalties, and the characteristics needed for an anomaly detection technique to be able to do this for us. I will describe the sparse coding technique and how it has all these properties that we need. And I'll then talk about how we engineer together a set of components using built-in Hadoop features as well as the early fault detection technique to provide a closed-loop solution that can mitigate penalties. I will conclude with an evaluation of fault managed MapReduce or FMR approach. Okay, so MapReduce, as we know, it is a widely used programming model as well as the software implementation that helps construct jobs that follow this paradigm. Its wide adoption is basically due to the fact that data distribution, job parallelization, task scheduling, and fault tolerance is provided by the framework and thus frees the programmer from these responsibilities. It's used in a wide range of domains, ranging from web indexing, recommendation systems, bioinformatics, ad analytics, and so on. So the basic architecture of MapReduce consists of the master node and a group of slave nodes. I'll not go into the details. The main two components to note are the compute layer and the underlying distributed data system layer on each node. On the master node, this is called as the job tracker and the name node, while on the slave nodes, we have the task tracker corresponding to the compute layer and the data node daemon corresponding to the distributed data system. Sorry, file system. Okay, so the existing fault tolerance is extremely simple. As and when a master detects that a particular task or a node has failed, the task or the set of tasks running on that node are re-executed. And this is good because the job can run to completion under certain conditions, which means that, say, if the number of nodes failed is less than the replication factor of the cluster, which is usually set at default to 3 or, you know, 5 if your applications are critical, it can tolerate so many failures. But the disadvantage of this is that this comes at the cost of performance penalties. A number of published literature has shown that these penalties can go up to, say, 140% for node failures, 35% for performance faults or outliers, 350% if the task tracker fails, and our experiments under various conditions have also shown that this penalty can go up to about 250% under the conditions we studied. Through some personal communication with Yahoo production engineers who use Hadoop for front-end phasing applications, they told us how they would typically allocate at least 2 hours for a single-hour job. So in order to be able to, because of the, when fault tolerance comes into play, these penalties will be suffered by your job. So our goal is to improve fault management in MapReduce through an online, on-demand, and closed-loop solution. We do not want to re-implement MapReduce, though there are approaches doing that, because we want it to be practically adopted by the large Hadoop user base community. Okay, so the first steps was to understand the performance penalties and look at what really affected it. We used a bunch of workloads from the Hadoop distribution as well as from the Puma benchmark, which is the Purdue MapReduce benchmark. Our fault load consisted of CPU hog processes, memory hog, and distributed hog processes, as well as crash failures in which we simply SSH'd into the node and killed the daemons that were running on it. We found that the penalties depended on a wide combination of these factors. They were completely nonlinear. We have a separate paper in which we characterize these faults and try to understand the factors that affect it. Now, the question is, what can we control among this? A lot of these factors were system-dependent or job-dependent, and hence we didn't have control over it. However, we could detect the fault slightly earlier than what is happening now and thus produce improvements. So this is just a timeline of a job. This is the time at which the failure occurs, and this is where the failure is being detected at the master node. We want to be able to leverage this region just before the fault or soon after when there are performance degradations so that we can invoke a dynamic resource scaling solution to overcome the penalties. So what is the anomaly detection problem we're looking at? We want to observe slave node operation and identify that a node is possibly failing as soon as possible. Now, what are the characteristics needed for this algorithm? First, we definitely need good accuracy, not just for identifying anomalies, but also to ensure that the false positive or the true negative rate should be high, or our false positives should be low. Next, it's an online technique, which means our testing time or the prediction computation time has to be really low so that we can invoke it multiple times. We prefer to have a short training time because applications can change, new applications can come into our system, and our models are application specific, and we want to be able to enable a system administrator to train models as fast as possible. Finally, it has to scale to a large number of nodes. Most Hadoop jobs run over a few tens or a few dozens or a few hundreds of nodes, and we want it to scale. So a technique which does something like peer comparison of all the existing nodes would be very hard to scale. Finally, it's the most important criteria. We want to be able to work with very limited label data. Expecting a data center system administrator to provide you with anomalous data that is labeled is extremely hard, so we want to minimize the dependence on this. The field of anomaly detection is vast. There are multiple techniques, many of which are customized for certain applications. We'll talk about how we go on to choose a particular application. The first challenge is the large amount of data available at each node. So we have not just a multidimensional feature vector describing everything from the task level operation, the MapReduce framework operation, the system software, as well as, you know, a virtualized layer, as well as hardware layer. But this is time varying, so we can't really look at an instance feature vector and make decisions about what is happening in the last period of time. So which of these features do we select? And finally, do we look for trends or threshold crossings or signatures, each of which has been the work, has been the way in which a number of works have taken, have followed. So this is just a screenshot from Ganglia showing various metrics during a MapReduce job. As we can see, there are a number of peaks, there are a number of threshold crossings, and it's a hard problem to be able to choose the right set of features. So what we do is we use a technique called application heartbeats, in which we instrument the MapReduce application to emit heartbeats. This is a technique that was proposed in ICAC 2011 by the CSAIL project in MIT, team at MIT, and it is different from in infrastructure heartbeats, which are common in most distributed systems. So the application is thus generating a sequence of heartbeats. We use a sliding window to calculate the heartbeat rate and then take a time series of these heartbeat rates to form what is the feature vector. So in this diagram, these are the heartbeat waves coming from six different nodes. One feature vector corresponds to this particular wave, and this is a sequence of feature vectors from each slave node. Here I'm just marking a slave node on which a performance fault was injected. And the goal of the heartbeat wave is to capture a pattern in which the task is executing. Now, is it feasible? Yes, we are losing the ideal of unmodified applications, and that's a disadvantage. But we believe this is a reasonable investment for an application that cares about its performance. And our experience was that it's quite easy to do, especially in MapReduce tasks, because they have a nice way of operating on key-value pairs, so it was easy to make this instrumentation. Okay, so that helps us move down from this whole range of system metrics, task metrics, to just using application heartbeat wave as a feature vector. The next challenge is the lack of labeled anomaly data. We don't just want labeled anomaly data, but we also want it to be representative of every possible anomaly that could happen in execution. This is extremely tough. And we show how in a simple multi-class classification problem, if we didn't have representative data, why our model would suffer. This helps us motivate the use of single class classification, which has the advantage that it can work with just using normal data for training. And I'll provide a very simple example to show that. Let's say we have these data points, circles, stars, and squares. Circle represents normal data. We have two types of anomalies, stars and squares. The goal of a multi-class classification formulation would be to tell us the set of hyperplanes, or lines in this case, that help us classify between these data points. Now, we're good as long as we only see anomalies from these two data types. If now a third type of anomaly comes in, which is a cross here, our classifier does not work anymore because it hasn't seen anomalies in this subspace of the region we're interested in. So what we really want is the single class formulation in which we want our algorithm to formulate or characterize only the normal data so that with reasonable confidence when a new data point comes in, which we haven't seen, we're able to say this is quite different from everything we've seen before, which is only this, and classify it as an anomaly. So for single class classification, we use something called sparse coding. The sparse coding technique is very commonly used in signal processing and image processing and has gained popularity over the last 5 years. What happens here is that we take a high-dimensional feature vector and represent it within a smaller subspace. And this is called as the sparse subspace. And the intuition behind this is that even though we have a lot of multidimensional observations, the actual generating processes underlying this data only lies within a short subspace. Now, once we find the short subspace, we code the given feature vector within the subspace. But this encoding or the sparse code representation will only be an approximation, which means that when we compare it to the original vector, there is always an error. And this error is what is going to help us. So when normal data is represented in sparse code, the errors are similar. They belong to a similar distribution. And when anomalous data is represented as sparse code, it belongs to a different distribution. This is a claim that we have observed and show empirically, and this is the fundamental claim in sparse coding. So here's a toy example of what this really means. So the black vectors, let's say, represent the training normal instances that we have with us to begin with. The blue and the red feature vectors represent data that's coming in. The blue is, again, a normal instance, while the red is an anomaly instance. So the blue instance can be represented using these vectors much more accurately than the anomaly data. This is because they lie within the same subspace. So the basis vectors of this particular subspace, which is our sparse code, helps us do this representation. Now, okay. So this is a set of experiments in which we take three different applications from our benchmarks set and show the magnitude of the errors for the anomaly and the normal data. So let's look at one graph. Along the x-axis, we have instance IDs, where the blue corresponds to the normal training data, the magenta corresponds to normal test data that we haven't seen when we constructed the sparse code, and the red corresponds to anomaly test data. So both of this we haven't seen. But once we see this, we try to determine the distribution of the error magnitudes, and that's what our model contains. And when a new instance comes in, we represent it as a sparse code and determine its error, and we find that it approximately has the same similar type of error distribution, while the anomaly test data has a distribution that is much different from the rest. So we see that the distributions are different with different values, but the difference between the normal and the test data is evident in our data sets. So the training process involves finding the sparse code, which is there are a set of algorithms called dictionary learning algorithms that help us determine this. We use something called orthogonal matching pursuit, an out-of-the-box algorithm that works pretty well and enables us to train fast. Then comes testing, in which we basically get a new instance, represent it using the sparse code, and determine its error, and then make a decision whether it belongs to the normal distribution or not. I mean, distribution of the normal data. It's not a normal distribution. So the consequence of this is that we get fast testing time because the matrix multiplication operations are quite simple here. There is no need for anomaly data. However, I want to point out that if we did have some anomaly data from some classes, we can use it in parameter tuning and make our algorithm more accurate. I'll talk about parameter tuning in an evaluation section. Finally, though these models use training from all the different nodes, the actual model is placed on a single slave node, and it does not have to communicate with other slave nodes. As a result, it's a decentralized local model, and it can scale well to a large number of nodes. So then I'll talk about the various components of the MAPE loop. First comes the monitoring and analysis modules. So here we have the MapReduce system. And for monitoring, we use Ganglia, which is an open source distributed monitoring tool, which works well for us, and it can scale up to about 2,000 nodes. And then we use something called as Node Health Script. Although this is a generic term, this is a feature provided in Hadoop, and it gives us a big advantage. So what it does is it can run any user-defined script on every slave node, and then it produces a binary signal, basically whether the node is healthy or not. And why this is a big win for us is as soon as a master node gets this information, also this information is piggybacked along normal communication between the slave and master, so we're not having this extra channel of communication, the master immediately blacklists that particular slave node and does not include it in its next scheduling cycle. So here, as we looked at earlier, the time of detection between a slave failing and the master identifying it is highly reduced here. It's almost instantaneous. So which is one of the reasons how we can put the system together. As soon as we detect an anomaly, we can let the master node know and not consider this slave node in the next scheduling cycle. Next comes the planning and execution modules. So within this is where the I forgot to talk about the analysis module. So here's where we extend Ganglia using something called metric modules, where we define the use of where we do the translation between heartbeats to heartbeat rates, create the feature vector, and give it as inputs to the anomaly detection module. I've marked the prediction. So our scaling heuristic needs to know about two details, namely, what is the time taken for this job to execute without faults and with faults. So this is a result of previous work that we've done in which we use regression machine learning models to predict the time taken for a job to execute, both with and without faults. So we use these models as input to the scaling heuristic and use a simple analytical model to determine how many nodes we need to add to the system to compensate for the penalty we're observing at that time. Finally, the execution model includes resource scaling, which is, we're using a virtualized environment, so we have the APIs to add new nodes to the system. And finally, blacklisting, which is an effect of the node health script helping us to immediately communicate with the master node and deschedule and prevent a slave node from being scheduled. Okay, now let's look at some of our evaluation results. We evaluate the accuracy of the anomaly detection technique for different application data sets. We considered 6 data sets. And we observe that our accuracy is greater than 0.8, both for the true positives as well as the true negatives. Then we look at different types of fault processes. We get reasonably good results for this case, too. And we also want to be able to see if we can use this in a heterogeneous Hadoop environment. And so this means that we have to retrain the model for each type of instance we have. And we did that, and we did find there was pretty good accuracy. So basically, to summarize, our results were that we could get true positive rates greater than 0.7 and true negative rates greater than 0.8 for all the experiments that we conducted. Okay, then another important thing in using machine learning techniques is the ability to tune the parameters for your technique. These were ranges that we are recommending, which is between 0.8 and 0.95, and these sparsity levels for the feature vector size that we're using based on general recommendations from the literature for this type of application. And we noticed that within this range, performance is quite stable. Though outside this range, we did find that the performance can vary quite a bit. We also evaluated the training and testing time for these application data sets and fault loads. Training was approximately 1 second, and testing time was much lower than that, enabling the use of this in an online loop. Okay, then, so yes, sparse coding does have the properties that we need, and it works well, but what about other techniques? So we look at the multilayer perceptron and k-means clustering. They perform reasonably okay, but they're still lower than sparse coding. However, they require anomalous training data and representative anomalous training data, which is one of the key motivations for using the sparse coding technique. So support vector machines is an optimization-based technique that works quite well, and it has a single class formulation, which is what we used. However, its actual quantitative results are also lower than what we could achieve with the sparse coding technique. The true positive rates were pretty good, but the true negative rates were much lower than what we could achieve with sparse coding. Okay, so to summarize the evaluation of the anomaly detection technique, we have reasonable accuracy, the training and testing times are sufficient, and we can scale to a large number of nodes because these are local models, and finally, the most important criteria is that we don't need anomalous training data for training. So, then evaluate the actual use of the detection technique within the closed-loop FMR operation. So we repeat the experiments from all the way from 10 nodes to about 62 nodes or 72 nodes along with the nodes that were reserved for scaling. Along the x-axis, we choose different times at which the faults are injected, namely at the beginning of the job, early, mid, and late. The first bar represents the time taken when there are no faults, and the second bar represents the time taken for built-in fault tolerance. As we see, the job does run to completion. However, it just takes a long amount of time. And the black bar represents the benefits achieved using fault management MapReducer. And on an average, our results, we were able to reduce penalties from about 119% to an average of 14%. In many cases, it was around 5%. 32-node case was the case where we had the highest or the minimum reduction in penalties. Okay, so this is an area of active research. There are many, many approaches that are trying to improve performance and the management of faults in MapReduce. Some of the work proposed new techniques, new designs of MapReduce. For example, the key problem in the current Hadoop implementation is that intermediate data is not replicated. This is why tasks need to be re-executed. There are papers that talk about how intermediate data could also be replicated for fault tolerance. And then there are a number of papers which deal with volunteer or opportunistic computing environments where faults in the name of churn in churn out is high, and so they recommend solutions to overcome that. But our work is different in that we want to be able to use Hadoop as it is and provide workarounds that can build on the current existing versions. Then we have works that focus specifically on fault handling. One of it is speculative execution, which was not a very performant, and then it was improved by a project called LATE from Berkeley. The difference between this is that their work focuses only on performance faults, while we focus on performance faults as well as crash faults. The Carnegie Mellon finger-pointing project has a number of detailed works on the diagnosis aspect. They do not propose closed-loop solutions, while we focus only on detection and recovery, though these two can work very well together, because for now we're just using a simple resource scaling option. By being able to diagnose the problem, we can choose much more intelligent recovery actions. Then there are works that come before online management, which is how do we allocate and configure our resources before we even start the job. And projects such as the Aroma project and the Starfish project from the University of Colorado and Duke University focus on these problems. Our work is most similar to works fault and performance management by these two teams. One is from HP Labs and UISC. It is a set of projects which started out with Araya and was extended. The difference is that they use analytical models to be able to determine slow jobs or node crash faults and then propose a technique to overcome them. They also use dynamic resource scaling as the recovery technique. Mantri and Jockey are two recent projects from Microsoft Research. They also propose closed-loop solutions. However, the approaches are different. Mantri uses threshold-based techniques to determine whether a task is an outlier or not. They have an extremely large amount of training data from Bing production clusters based on which they identify the thresholds beyond which a task would be considered an outlier. In our case, we observe that using task operation. Finally, the Jockey project has a different approach. They use simulation models, which are also online, but they use a discrete event simulator that's fast enough to once again make these detections about whether a job is slow or not. And in both these cases, it's either kill and restart of tasks or the use of more nodes, which is the scaling, which is the recovery technique that they use. So a little bit of future work that we're working on is, one is these models are application specific, which means we did make this choice because, one, we observed that from a number of production workload traces that 80% of the jobs are typically repeated. It's usually the data that changes, but MapReduce jobs remain same with a little bit of evolution. So what we want to be able to do is, can we have incremental learning models? This is the field of machine learning in which there are a lot of questions in terms of which training data do you keep, how do you sample them, and how do you create models on the fly? Finally, our technique works only if there is at least one wave remaining for the job for scaling to help. If we didn't have a wave remaining, scaling is not going to help. And so we're looking at other remediation techniques such as migration or vertical scaling that can help with this. At this point, our work is best effort basis. We want to look at some other techniques that might help us provide a guarantee for the performance. Finally, a single MapReduce job is useful only to a certain extent. We want to be able to look at sequence of jobs and see how we can do online performance management for them. The analysis of performance penalties is in some of our older work, and this is the work that talks about the performance prediction models using machine learning regression. And yes, to summarize, built-in fault tolerance in Hadoop is insufficient because of performance penalties. Our goal is to use anomaly detection techniques to mitigate these penalties. So I'm ready to answer any questions.
Hi, I'm Shekhar from Palo Alto Research Center. Okay. I'm wondering that you said that peer similarity is not scalable, and mm-hmm. I agree with that. But since Hadoop scheduler already maintains all the data at the central entity, mm-hmm. I'm not trying to convince myself that why would I use this one, because if you are taking data from ganglia for every node, and it has a hell lot of data, ganglia mm-hmm. produces lots of trace data. And peer similarity is very, very simple approach, mm-hmm. and that gives pretty good results, at least on homogeneous cluster.
So what's actually happening is the aggregation of data by ganglia, the heartbeat waves, yes, we are using metric modules from ganglia, but they're all happening locally. The actual information that comes to the master is just a binary signal, healthy or not healthy, and that's the decision we use. The anomaly detection module is local.
Yeah, okay. And second question, since your paper said it's early detection, mm-hmm. How many samples you actually use to train the data, I mean, for the training data?
It varied between 500 samples to about 1,500 samples for each application type.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay.
Hi. I first would like to say that I really like the clarity of the overall framework and the fact that you use this explicit MAPK loop diagram. And then I was interested by the perspective you mentioned about giving guarantees, mm-hmm. Which brings me to the question of would there be, given that it is an automated loop, it can have interesting properties of convergence or divergence, or maybe the learning improves across looping, and mm-hmm. would that be the kind of guarantees you're looking for, or which would they be?
Oh, well, actually, our learning is static in the sense yeah. that it's not incremental. So I can't yet reason about convergence or change in learning over time. But I think that is a good direction in terms of, if the application characteristic changes and we're able to learn it, can we provide these guarantees, would be the sequence of questions we would have to ask. But
okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, hi, Ulla Mengshul from CMU. Interesting topic and talk. Thank you. And one question I have was about the machine learning, and in particular the features you used. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can talk a little bit more about the features. Did you use temporal features? Did you use static features? You had a lot of time series graphs there, I noticed.
So the feature vector consists of a sequence of application heartbeat rates.
Okay.
So it captures the pattern in which the computation that we have captured using the heartbeats is proceeding. So the feature vector is each feature dimension is nothing but a heartbeat rate, which is the number of heartbeats per sliding window.
Okay, so you're essentially capturing sort of the shape of the heartbeat. So
yes.
When is the heartbeat? Okay.
Yes, yes.
Okay, I got it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks. I have a question which is kind of related to one of your previous questions. Can you maybe quantify the benefits of this approach compared to the related work which you mentioned? In terms of percentage, or in terms of any metric, you said, I will apply these techniques, mm-hmm. they work nicely, but how do you compare them to the related work?
That's a good question, actually. So I can look at, for example, the closest work is Mantri and Jockey. Although I can see what they've done, it's hard to reproduce those because we don't have a lot of details in terms of, how are those thresholds chosen. They're usually specified in terms of these in qualitatively, but not quantitatively. So I can only answer these questions qualitatively. For example, Mantri and Jockey both don't consider hard faults. They both consider only performance faults. So I don't have a quantitative way to compare these techniques.
And with respect to the faults, mm-hmm. do you also consider faults from the hardware faults, for instance, a drive which might be failing or things like that?
So we capture them in software because it's a manifestation. The manifestation of a hardware fault is that the data node daemon does not work anymore. So no other so the reduced task phase, for example, can't read from that node.
What is if it's partially working? Like, it might work, but sporadically, mm-hmm. like the response to some requests, but stop at some point and do it again.
So if it's partial in terms of, say, a degradation, that would be, for example, captured by the disk hog process, because that the map task process, which is of interest, is now being slowed down by a disk hog process that we've injected on that node. That's how we capture a partial failure.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Okay.